get started, we have somewhat of a critical mass, and people will trickle in. My original idea when I put together this class was that we were going to assume, and we've mentioned it before in previous classes, sort of in passing, but we were going to assume, there are source sheets over here for those who don't have that, we were going to assume that Megillas Esther was a book that was composed at a certain time, namely during the Second Temple period, and then we still are going to compare Megillas Esther with other books that were composed during the Second Temple period of a similar character to Megillas Esther, and attempt to tease out what it is that made Megillas Esther meaningful enough that it has become incorporated into our tradition, and why exactly, or rather, what exactly do we stand to gain from lending Megillas Esther the credence and respect and yira that we as a people have done. The problem is that I ran into was that I wasn't clear myself on the grounds of my on what grounds I was assuming that Megillas Esther was composed when it was. So after having gone through the sources, I've given a class on this before, but having gone through all the sources, I think that it might be pertinent. It might be useful for all of us to orient ourselves and really ask ourselves the question, how do we date Megillas Esther? There are various ways that we could go about this. The fact of the matter is that in Megillas Esther, it's clear that the author of Megillas Esther, the finished work as we have it, whoever it is, whether it's Mordechai or Esther or whether it's somebody else, was clearly familiar with how the Persian court worked during the Persian period. There are lots of Persian loan words in the biblical Hebrew of Megillas Esther. So there's all this sorts of archaeology that we could go through. I think the clearest criterion that we have for dating Megillas Esther, no, I'll just stand up so people can hear. Well, the clearest criterion that we have for dating Megillas Esther, I think, is a name. In other words, there is one character in all of Megillas Esther who is not just famous in our tradition, but is famous in the sort of tradition of world history. And who might that be? Ahasuerus. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is this. In other words, Megillas Esther sets itself during the reign of a Persian emperor, an Achaemenid Persian emperor, named Ahasuerus. Now, I've given you on the top here a timeline. We're just going to refer to it. We're not going to read through it, obviously. We're going to just refer to it briefly. But I've given you a timeline at the top here of the different Persian emperors. Oh, and for those, just to clarify, because I realized I didn't make it clear at the top, we're going to take a quick break from Judaism and Christianity today, and we're going to do a unit on Purim. I think it'll be, I hope we're going to do a unit on Purim today, and then on Monday, I know because there are going to be people at APEC, so I don't want people who are going to be there to miss out on our regularly scheduled programming, so we're going to do one more unit on Purim. It will, like this one, be self-contained, and then as soon as everybody's back, we will get back to our regularly scheduled programming. So anyway, I've given you a timeline of the emperors here. Now, there are a series of emperors that are mentioned, of Persian emperors that are mentioned in Tanakh. The latter Persian emperors until Alexander, after Artaxerxes I, who I've given you here, are not mentioned in Tanakh. So of the ones that are mentioned in Tanakh, I've basically given you the options for who Ahasuerus might be. And depending on who Ahasuerus is, that will actually have major implications for what message we take away, I believe, from Megillas Esther. So now let's take a look. I've given you the emperors. We've mentioned either in... Yes. Right, so I'm saying of the emperors until Alexander the Great overthrew the Persian empire in 333, whenever it was. So now, of the Persian emperors, so any for those who have been in the previous semester or two semesters before that, or who were... or who were with me this past Shabbos, Susan can help with that. We'll know that Ahasuerus could not have been the first of the emperors mentioned here. Who's the first of the emperors mentioned? In other words, the earliest Persian emperor, that is Cyrus. Who is Cyrus is mentioned in Tanakh, and we know who he is. What is his name in Biblical Hebrew? Koresh. Right? Koresh is mentioned in Yeshayahu. He's mentioned in Sefer Ezra. All of the books that talk about the return of the Jewish people from the first Babylonian exile to Eretz Yisrael when they build the second temple, the person who sends them back is the first of the Persian emperors, and his name is Cyrus, Cyrus the Great. Now, Cyrus had a son and a rather short-lived successor whose name is Cambyses. Now, Cambyses is not an obvious candidate for somebody mentioned in Tanakh, so we'll have to reserve judgment for the moment. Perhaps, some have suggested this in the past, maybe Ahasuerus is Cambyses. So let's bracket that for now and leave it aside. And we'd have now, of course, we'd have to figure out how we get from the name Cambyses, which is preserved by Herodotus, to the word Ahasuerus. In other words, we have to find some sort of connection. Yes?
So the theory that I heard many years ago is Cyrus being actually a progeny of Esther, and that's why he's...
Right. So that, I believe, is recorded in Seder Olam Rabbah. It makes its way into the Bavli, and that is the general rabbinic view of things. It might be helpful at a certain point, sometime over the course of our historical ramblings, to do a class on how Chazal, maybe we'll do this later in this unit, how Chazal came up with the chronology that they have. We'll just say briefly, and there are books written about this, we'll say very briefly, and there are major rabbinic figures who have signed on to this conclusion, I'm not the first one to say this, Chazal's chronology in terms of their dates and the way that they calculated the years of time is not correct. The reason that it's not correct is because totally because they severely underestimated how long the Persian period was. It's easy to explain why this occurred. The reason is because they were using as their source for chronology Tanakh. Tanakh only mentions four Persian emperors: Koresh, Daryavesh, Ahasuerus, and Artaxerxes. Those are the four emperors that are mentioned by Tanakh. The reason Tanakh mentions only four is not because it thought there were only four, achas v'shalom, but because Tanakh only thought that four were important with respect to their impact on the Jewish people. Now, Chazal did not realize that. We are standing on the shoulders of giants. We have at our disposal the inscriptions, the personal inscriptions of the Persian emperors, where they record their lines of descent. We also have at our disposal the writings of Herodotus and the writings of Thucydides, to the extent that those are helpful. We have at our disposal all sorts of sources that deal with the chronology of the Persian emperors, so we know the correct chronology of the Persian emperors. The correct chronology of the Persian emperors, as we'll see in a moment, is that Cyrus certainly predated Esther and Ahasuerus. The only question is by how much. So that's the question that we're going to have to deal with. So Cyrus, we know who that is in the biblical literature, Koresh. Darius, we also, and so now, Cambyses will bracket. Bardia is a person who rebelled against the rightful rulers of the people who claimed to be the rightful rulers of the Persian Emperor. We're not so concerned with him. He ruled for a month or so. After Bardia comes the great emperor, Darius the Great. It was under his rule that Baishani was built. Now, this is very important because of who comes after Darius. Now, Darius, we know, also has a name in Tanakh that's easily identifiable as Darius, and that is Daryavesh Malka, King Darius. So Koresh and Daryavesh are taken care of. Now, bear in mind, if you look on that timeline, we know that Baishani, the second temple, was constructed during the reign of Darius. Now that's important because Darius' son is named Xerxes. That's what Herodotus calls him, Xerxes. Now you may be familiar with Xerxes from the movie 300. Xerxes is the emperor who reigns while Baishani, he's the first emperor after Darius to reign while Baishani has already been built. What that means is that if Xerxes, now Xerxes does not have an obvious counterpart in terms of the name of a biblical Persian emperor, so maybe Xerxes is Ahasuerus. We're going to have to investigate this. Now Artaxerxes is also easy to identify, that's Artaxerxes. So now the only two candidates that we have for who Ahasuerus could be are Cambyses and Xerxes. Neither of them obviously correspond to the name Ahasuerus, but as we'll see, one of them actually does. Now, why is this important? If you look ahead, you'll see who I think Ahasuerus, who we are 99.99999% certain that Ahasuerus is. We'll prove it, but why does this make a difference? In other words, what is the nafka mina in terms of when Megillas Esther was written? Was it written before the building of Baishani, or after the building of Baishani? In other words, when Mordechai and Esther are saving the Jewish people in Shushan, when Mordechai is saving the day, when Esther is saving the day, when they're creating this holiday of Purim, are they doing this while the Jewish people are still, theoretically at least, in exile? Or are they doing this when the Second Temple is built and standing in Yerushalayim? I think that this has major implications for the character of Megillas Esther. So take a look at the next source, which is basically the identity of Ahasuerus. And it happens to be, yes?
Well, permission was given to rebuild the emperor, give the utensils back.
Right, so Cyrus, already in his declaration, which is recorded in Sefer Ezra and Perek Aleph and Perek Vav, gives permission for all of the utensils that had been taken by Nebuchadnezzar to be sent back with the Jews to rebuild their temple.
And that fits in with the story. So
of which story?
Of Esther.
Well, Esther never mentions the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash ever. That's a midrash in Chazal. Kalim Michalim Shonim, Chazal Darshan, that the utensils that were used by Achashverosh at his banquet in the very beginning of Megillas Esther, that those Kalim were the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash. Nowhere does the Megillah indicate that. In fact, the Megillah seems to indicate is that they were nice Kalim. Chazal Darshan is because Chazal believed that this took place prior to Cyrus being born. That's part of how Chazal get there. And in point of fact, the Beis HaMikdash was already built at this time, so they couldn't have been the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash. But the point of that Midrash is actually to highlight how degrading and insulting that feast would have been in the eyes of the Jews, who would have been excluded. And that's an important point. Yes?
Do you accept the fact that the first temple was destroyed in 586, and they were there for 70 years, which would meant that it ended in 516?
Right.
How do these things jive with it? It seems to be all out of whack.
In what sense?
Well, they were there for hundreds of years in Persia, after
Baal Sheni was rebuilt.
After Baal Sheni was rebuilt.
So yes, the Jews, there's a massive Jewish presence, as far as we can tell, in Persia, from Persia, Babylonia, that sort of area, in the Fertile Crescent, basically, from when they are expelled in the year 586, probably through all the way through the Talmudic period. That's, as far as we know, the community in Babylonia is a very old one.
So why did they just pick up when they had the decree against them and leave?
All right, so why didn't they, in other words, during the Purim story, you mean?
During the Purim.
Ah, okay. So that's a good question. So I think that's one of the points that we're going to try and have to explore. In other words, what can we take away, if we can identify, and we'll do that in a moment, if we can pinpoint the story of Megillas Esther as having taken place when Baal Sheni is built?
Because they're still part of the empire and they're still susceptible to be victimized.
Right, but I think Mr. Deegan's question is, if they were being victimized, it's clear that Jews could go back because Jews did go back.
They were still part of the empire. There was no escape.
It's true, but the Jews of Eretz Israel don't seem to have been impacted by the decrees of Haman, at least as far as we can tell from the story.
Throughout the kingdom, every place, the decree is every land.
True, but then you would probably expect at some point during the Sifrei Tanakh that take place during the reign of Ahasuerus, like Nehemiah and Ezra, that this would be mentioned, and nowhere is it mentioned. So it's likely, and as we'll see in a moment, there are other. When we get to our discussion of one of the other books that we're going to talk about, we'll see that usually when decrees against the Jews of this sort are usually a little bit more local. But the point is well taken. In terms of who Ahasuerus is, it happens to be that we can pretty much figure this out with 100% certainty. I've given you in that little chart there on the identity of Ahasuerus. So the Hebrew we know is Ahasuerus. Those two spellings under the heading Hebrew, those are the two ways that basically, with one exception, is how the name Ahasuerus is spelled in the Megillah. Next, that I've given you the Greek, which is Xerxes. Now, the old Persian, that's the third column from the left, this is how Xerxes spelled his own name in his Persian inscriptions at his palace at Persepolis and on an inscription called the Behistun inscription. This is how Xerxes spelled his name. There are several documents that we have from Xerxes, and he spelled his name Chshayarsha. So the basic consonants are Ch, Sh, R, and another Sh. So a chet, a shin, a resh, and another shin. Those are the consonants, the main consonants of the word Ahasuerus. And if you look through that sheet in the Aramaic Elephantine papyri, the Jews who lived in the military colony of Elephantine, which for those of you who were there in our first semester, we explored a little bit about Elephantine, the Jews who lived there, who were dating their contracts, their sort of economic contracts, by the reign of the emperor, so those who lived during the reign of Ahasuerus, spelled his name Chshayarash. So you can tell how we got from Ahasuerus to Chshayarash. Now, why is there an Aleph? This is the boring part. Why is there an Aleph? The answer is because in Hebrew, you can't have a single syllable that has two consonants in it. So, the Latin word, specularium, what is that in Hebrew, in the Talmud? Aspaclaria. You can't have one syllable that begins sp. That's two consonants. So it's aspaclaria. strategos, that's a Greek word. So what is that word in Talmud? Estatargia, right? So you always add what's called a prosthetic aleph at the beginning to break up two consonants. So chesha, a chet, and a shin could not have been the beginning of the letter. So they added an aleph, as everybody else did, and I've given you in that last column, the Akkadians and the Elamites, they did the same thing to the name of Achashverosh. So anyone who was a Semitic speaker, unlike Persian, which is not a Semitic language, anyone who was a Semitic speaker added aleph at the beginning of the word. So bottom line is, we can pinpoint with near certainty that the person who we call Achashverosh, whom we identify as Achashverosh in the Tanakh, was the Emperor Xerxes, which means that Megillas Esther takes place while Bayis Sheni is already built. Okay. Adkan. Now here's my question. Are there other books that perhaps might be similar to Esther that deal with the same problem that Esther is dealing with? In other words, Esther, it's clear, I think, to me at least, that if Esther takes place when the Beis HaMikdash is already built, it must be then that the goal of Esther is to communicate to the Jews of the diaspora how to live. In other words, if you should go back. It's clear from the other prophets that discuss the imperative to go back and build the second temple, and Sefer Ezra and Sefer Nehemiah and books like that, it was clear that God expected the Jewish people to return to their land, reestablish sovereignty in the state of Israel, and rebuild the second temple and so on. But let's say you didn't go back. So if you didn't go back, so what should you do? Abandon your Judaism entirely? The answer is no. You had to have some sort of blueprint for living a productive, wholesome life in the diaspora. Megillas Esther addresses the question of how to accomplish that. Now, it happens to be that there are other books, I'd like to mention two works in particular, that also seem to address this question. They're both composed at a time when the Second Temple is standing, and they all address the question of the Jews being persecuted and responding to that persecution. The two works that I'd like to mention are as follows. Some of you may know that at a certain point, all the books of the Bible are translated into Greek. And this is called, and this translation project is called the Septuagint. The Septuagint because it literally means the translation of the 70, because the legend is that they had 70 people work on the 70 rabbis or 70 anybodies work on this translation. And eventually the translation comes to be. It doesn't all happen at once, but over time there's this Greek translation. Now, in the Greek translation of the Book of Esther, there are all these additions to the story that you don't find in Megillas Esther that we have. They were not original to the story. They were written originally in Greek. They're not translations of a Hebrew version. The additions are all interesting because they're all the sorts of things that we always ask whenever you hear a shir, when you're in fourth grade, when you're in high school, when you're in college, on Megillas Esther. What's the thing that everybody always asks? What's the problem with Megillas Esther? What's wrong with Megillas Esther? Who doesn't appear in Megillas Esther? God! God never appears anywhere in Megillas Esther. Why not? So we all have to come up with all sorts of answers and taiches for how Megillas Esther really is a bit frummer than we think that it is. Now, the Septuagint translators were well aware of this problem, and this is why there are all these additions to the Book of Esther that far from the narrative a little bit. So what's in these additions to the Book of Esther? The answer is, first of all, Mordechai is given a nevuah at the beginning of the book that tells him all about, in cryptic language, about all of the events that are going to transpire. It's a vision of dragons fighting with each other, and at the end of the book, he gets an interpretation of the nevuah. One of the dragons is Mordechai, one of them is Haman, and so on and so forth. Then, there is one thing that everybody, all the Rebbeim always ask me, what's missing from Esther? What did the Jews not do? What do Mordechai and Esther not do when they're in trouble that they probably should have done, we expect? Don't pray, right? They don't daven. They don't beseech HaKadosh Baruch Hu to save them. So the additions to the Septuagint added a long prayer that Mordechai makes and a long prayer that Esther makes. And there are two other things that are missing. When Haman makes his decree, or convinces Achashverosh to make this decree against the Jewish people. So Achashverosh says that he sends out a letter to all of the people informing them that Haman's decree is in place. We don't have the text of that letter. The Megillah doesn't provide it to us. So the translator filled in what he thought might have been a fun way to, you know, in other words, if we could imagine what that letter would have said, this is what it would have said. And then, again, the Megillah tells us that at the end of the story, when the decree against the Jews is rescinded, that Achashverosh sent out another letter, rescinding the decree. But again, we don't have the text. So the Septuagint translators imagined what that text would have been. So those are basically the additions. All the things that we wish were in the Megillah, because it would put all of our Rebbeim out, or that I don't wish were in the Megillah, because it would put Rebbeim out of a job. So those things are the things that the Septuagint translators put, shtupped into the text of Megillas Esther. Yes? No.
One of the two questions.
No.
What the heck was the ninth string?
Right. What is Esther doing here? Right. So let's actually table that for a second, because we're going to discuss that very question if we have a chance at the end. Right. But
she was chosen.
Right. So right, that's true. So the question is whether or not, in other words, Chazal debate this question, what was the halachic status of Esther vis-a-vis her relationship with Achashverosh? That's an important question. It actually has halachic implications today in areas as diverse as intermarriage and spying. In other words, let's say you're a spy for the Mossad and you have to sleep with somebody in order to do what you need to do. It's called a honeypot operation. So is that mutter? So a lot of the case law when it comes to halacha, this is actually a lemaisa case. There have been cases where the Mossad has been engaged in this. Those of you who remember Mordechai... So those of you who remember the Vanunu Dimona reactor secrets case, so that was a major issue there. So the So the poskim discuss how to apply these cases, but whatever the case may be, in other words, we have to figure out literarily, from a literary standpoint, what is the role of Esther in this story, and what are we supposed to take away from it? So those are the Septuagint additions to the Book of Esther. That's one important work that we have to keep in mind. In other words, there were people who lived, and now the additions to the Book of Esther were made probably in the first century before the Common Era, maybe a little bit later. Josephus already has them. So they were made while Bayesheni was standing. These were people who were living in the diaspora while the temple stood, who were commenting and interpreting the Book of Esther and filling in things that they thought should have been in there. So we're going to have to look at what those things were, and we're going to have to ask ourselves, what can these additions to the Book of Esther teach us about what the Book of Esther, in fact, does not say and what it should mean to us? Yes. True, that is correct. And Ezra thought that they needed to...
Nobody said that she was a bit sedatus.
Who, Esther?
Yeah, why would someone say she's a sedatus?
The strong implication, it's a good question, Chazal make this assumption, but even from a literary standpoint, the strong implication of the Megillas Esther is that Esther is a heroine. I can't think of a single tradition in Jewish literature that would cast, whether rabbinic or non-rabbinic, that would cast Esther as either a villain or even just an unsavory character. But even as someone, in other words, the broad-based assumption of Jewish sources, whether rabbinic, as I said, whether rabbinic or non-rabbinic or pre-rabbinic, they all seem to assume that Esther is a heroine. So whether or not that's the pshat, I suspect that it is. I strongly suspect that it's the pshat. That's the strong implication of the Megillah, of the text of the Megillah.
Why would that take away from her frontside? Why wouldn't make her being a heroine, what's up with it being from?
Well, it might not. The only point that I want to make is that all of the questions that we generally ask of the Megillah, which is why isn't prayer here? Why isn't God here? Why isn't Nevuah here? All of those things, clearly those things not bothered people, but occurred to people not just 20 years ago, but 2,000 years ago, 2,100 years ago. So those questions are old questions. That's the only point I want to make.
Question.
Yes?
I think next and then they go back and they rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Is it reconstituted in Yerushalayim?
Right, so the problem with the Anshei Knesset HaGdola is that we don't know anything about it other than that Chazal asserted that they existed. No source mentions them, that is a non-rabbinic source. We don't know anyone who was on the Anshei Knesset HaGdola other than people who are in other respects famous, like Mordechai. So in other words, Chazal... So the assumption seems to... The way the process there seems to have worked, that Chazal identified people who lived during the Persian period who would have been obvious candidates for the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, and then says that that's what they were. Whether that's another, we don't really have any way of verifying it one way or the other. We assume that there is an Anshei Knesset HaGdola, that's a chain in the link of the Masorah, but more than that, we don't really know. Now, there's another work that is composed in the diaspora during this period that in many respects is identical to the Book of Esther. It does not make it into our canon. It is called the Third Book of Maccabees. Now, it has nothing to do with the Maccabees at all, with Hanukkah, with the Chashmonaim, with anything like that. Why is it called the Third Book of Maccabees? Because in the Septuagint, it comes after the Second Book of Maccabees. This is why it's called Third Maccabees. The original Greek, one of the Septuagint manuscripts gives it the name Ptolemaica, which is probably a more accurate name, because it deals with the reign of one of the Ptolemy kings, one of the Ptolemy emperors of Egypt. Now, the story of the third book of Maccabees, and we'll see why this is important in a moment. The story of the third book of Maccabees is important because it basically tells the following story. It tells the story of the Jews living in Alexandria and in and around Egypt in the 3rd century before the Common Era. It was composed probably 150 to 200 years later, but it tells the story of Jews who are living in Egypt and Alexandria under the rule of the Ptolemies. This is after Alexander conquers the world, his empire splits, you have the Seleucids, which would eventually rule Eretz Yisrael, and that would be where Antiochus in the Hanukkah story comes from. There in the north in Syria, and in the south in Egypt are the Ptolemies. Now, the Jews who lived under the Ptolemies, the following story that they wrote. The story goes like this. The emperor Ptolemy IV, Philopator, fights this battle at the city of Rafiach, which still exists today, at the sort of Rafiach crossing. He fights this battle at Rafiach against one of the Seleucid emperors, Antiochus III, grandfather, whatever it is, brother of Antiochus IV. So he fights this battle. While he's fighting the battle, somebody tries to assassinate him, and this Jew, an apostate Jew, Dositheus, saves his life, and the king is very grateful to him. That's how the story begins. Sound familiar to you from the Esther story? We'll explore what the exact parallels are in a moment. Then what happens? So then the king tries to, after he wins this battle, he goes on sort of a victory lap around all of his territories, and one of his stops on his victory lap is Yerushalayim. And when he gets there, he wants to go into the Beis HaMikdash and have everybody bow down to him. The people say no, and the Kohanim insist that this not come to pass. Everybody davens to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The king is stricken with paralysis, and he's unable to enter the Beis HaMikdash. So, because he's so angry at the Jewish people for disrespecting him in this fashion, he issues a decree against the Jewish people. He accuses them of disloyalty to the state. They're a separate people. They have different laws. And he issues a decree to all of the people throughout his empire in Alexandria that on this such and such a day, the Jewish people should be wiped out. What you're going to do is put them in chains, send them to me, I'll gather them in the Hippodrome, and I'll kill them all. Okay. Eventually the king makes several attempts to, and then in the interim, he has these grand feasts. These two grand feasts, over the course of which he attempts to put into action his plot to kill the Jewish people. You should be hearing echoes of the story of Megillas Esther. He tries to put into action his plan to kill the Jewish people. He is constantly thwarted in his desires to exterminate the Jewish people until finally, at the end of the day, God comes along and drives him insane and causes him to have, miraculously, a change of heart. He ends up deciding that the day upon which the Jews should have been killed will instead, v'nafochu, turn into a day, and this is the language that the Greek book uses, that instead will turn into a day where the Jewish people will in fact kill their enemies. So the Jewish people round up all of the apostate Jews who had betrayed them and they kill them. And they decide at the end, which is grisly, and they decide at the end of the story that we're going to establish this as a day for all time that we will celebrate that we will celebrate with our brethren to commemorate this as a holiday, as a day upon which the Jews of Alexandria and Egypt were saved. That's the story of Third Maccabees. Now, you should have heard over the course of that retelling several parallels to the Esther story, just to make them explicit. Both of them are stories about how the Jewish people had a decree against them, a national decree against them to destroy all of them. The decree was eventually rescinded by the king. In both cases, there are two letters sent out. One letter is sent out saying the Jews should be killed, and then eventually another letter is sent out saying they should not be killed. In both cases, they are both royal feasts that feature at key moments in the text. In both cases, there's a plot to assassinate the king, and a Jew steps in and saves the king. Both stories have the number 300. The Jews in 3rd Maccabees kill 300 of their enemies. The Jews in Megillas Esther on the second day in Shushan kill 300 of their enemies. There are all sorts of parallels between the two works. Now, the fact that there are all these sorts of parallels can possibly tell us two things. The first thing that it might tell us is that one work, the earlier work would have been Esther, Esther was written during the Persian period, would have influenced the third book of Maccabees. Now, this doesn't necessarily need to be the case. Just because they have thematic parallels doesn't really tell us anything. However, what I think is the more interesting option, and this is what I think we should explore, is this. There are two works here that are very, very similar and deal with similar themes. Jews living in the diaspora while the temple is already built, being persecuted in the diaspora and having to come to grips with what does it really mean for us to live here? What are we doing here? In other words, should we just run away? Should we find some way to productively relate to the crown? Should we be sort of passive-aggressive? How should we exist in the diaspora if we're not going to go back to Eretz Yisrael? What should we do? How should we do it? One of these books makes it into our Tanakh, the other one doesn't. The question is, what can Esther tell us that distinguishes it from the third book of Maccabees? So that is going to be my question. Question number two that I want to ask is this. I mentioned earlier that there are all these Greek additions to the book of Esther. It happens to be that there are many points of contact between the book of 3rd Maccabees and the book of Esther, and some of those contacts, in fact, as we're going to see, almost all of them, of those parallels, actually relate to the additions to the book of Esther. Now, the question is, why is this important? So, just before we explain why that's important, I'd just like to give you one example of how the book of 3rd Maccabees relates not just to Megillas Esther, but also to those extra Septuagint additions to the book of Esther. There's one passage that I'd like you to take a look at. So take a look at this. What I've showed you is the linguistic method of dating. I'd just like to give you two paragraphs side by side. There's a phrase in both of them that appears in only these two places in all of Greek literature that ever existed up until this point, which I think demonstrates that. And there are several cases like this. There are over a dozen cases like that. In other words, where there are two words that appear only in these two places, either in all of Greek literature or at least in all of the Septuagint, which I think show that there is a relationship between the Greek additions to the book of Esther and 3rd Maccabees. And so just to quickly take a look, in 3rd Maccabees, just to sort of give you a taste of what it is, for the interest of time, we won't read the whole passage, but just to show you, in the passage on the left, there's the phrase fire and spear. I've given you the Greek, which is puri kai dopati. And that same phrase appears in the Greek additions to Esther, Dopati Kai Puri. That phrase, spear and fire, juxtaposed together, appears nowhere else in all of Greek literature until this point. The only two places they appear are in the Greek additions, the Septuagint additions to the book of Esther, and in the third book of Maccabees. What this tells me, I think what this should tell all of us, and I can multiply this example many times, is that even if, in other words, we have these two books, Esther, Megillas Esther, and the third book of Maccabees. And then after the third book of Maccabees is written, we have the Greek additions to the book of Esther. Now it's clear from this, I think, that the Greek additions to the book of Esther were not just commenting on the book of Esther by adding things to it. They were also incorporating their knowledge and awareness of the perspective of the third book of Maccabees. So the question that we have to ask ourselves, and this is where I hope things will get interesting, is this. If the stories of 3rd Maccabees and Esther are so similar, are there, in fact, places where they differ, which might be able to tell us why Esther sort of won out in our tradition? And, in fact, can we use these Greek additions to the book of Esther to help us point to those theological issues, where Esther, in fact, distinguishes itself from these other books that talk about persecution and the diaspora and so on and so forth? I think the answer is yes. So take a look at these sources and comparing and contrasting Esther and 3rd Maccabees. So here, pay close attention to the passages that we're going to read, and what I'd like to do is try and figure out the different perspectives in Megillas Esther and in the 3rd book of Maccabees, and I'd like to figure out why those things are important. Now, number one, take a look at the passages on the left are from Esther, the ones on the right are from the 3rd book of Maccabees. So this one, the first one's first. Vayivez be'inav l'shloach yad b'mardachai levado, ki higidu lo as am mardachai, vayivakesh haman l'hashmid es kol ha-yehudim asher b'chol malchus ha-chashverosh am mardachai. It seemed contemptible in Haman's eyes. In other words, Haman had been disrespected by Mardachai, and now he's all upset. And the Pasuk tells us, it seemed contemptible in the eyes of Haman to lay hands on Mordechai alone, for they had made known to him the people of Mordechai. So in other words, he figured out that it wasn't just that Mordechai was a jerk, he was also a Jew, even worse, right? Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordechai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Okay, that's one passage. The equivalent passage so to speak, at least rhetorically, in the third book of Maccabees is this. Now, pay close attention to what is going on here, and then I'd like to explore what the difference is between these two passages. The third book of Maccabees says, he, the emperor Ptolemy, proposed to disseminate blame publicly against the Jewish nation. In other words, this is also the same point of the narrative. Ptolemy has just been disrespected by the Jewish people, he wasn't allowed into their temple, and now he's so angry and hot and bothered that he decides to propound or promulgate this decree against the Jewish people. Now, what distinguishes Esther from 3 Maccabees in this case is one crucial point.
Well, it's also the from whom it originates.
Excellent.
Sort of the, and it's sort of like the Achashverosh is the puppet and Haman is the puppeteer. And in Maccabees, it's sort of the king is the one who's directly doing it.
Excellent. So, this is a crucial point. In Megillas Esther, the threat against the Jews does not originate from the king, does not originate from the crown, which would have represented to the Jews of this time, to anybody in this time, the state. In other words, it's not that the state is persecuting the Jewish people, as Susan said. In other words, Achashverosh is duped. And we'll come back to that in the next source. The threat originates from the vizier. And the Megillah goes to, I think, great lengths to imply that this was really a private plot by Haman and his family. His conspirators are always family members. In other words, this is sort of a private initiative that was coming from sort of a mole in the otherwise either neutral or positive or positive towards the Jews attitude of the government. In Maccabees, the threat originates from the crown itself. It's the state, the Gentile state, that is persecuting the Jewish people. So the attitude already towards society in Esther is one of either positivity or perhaps neutrality. We'll have to explore that. In Maccabees, there's already this sort of essential divide, this essential attitude that at the end of the day, we are always going to be a persecuted minority and we have to act as such. Okay, source number one. Take a look at the next source that I've given you. Vayomer hamelech Achashverosh, vayomer l'Esther amalka, mi hu zev ezehu asher mela'o libo la'asos kein. Right, Xerxes, in other words, this is the point. It's my favorite point of the Megillah. This is the point at which Esther has finally revealed herself as a Jew to Xerxes, to Achashverosh, in front of Haman, and she accuses Haman and says, this is the person who's going to, there's somebody who's trying to destroy my entire people, a people that have been loyal to you, a people that have served you well, and he's trying to destroy them all. And Achashverosh's reaction is very strong. King Xerxes asks Queen Esther, who is he? Where is he? The man who has dared to do such a thing. This is the point at which there's a change in, there's sort of a change in the circumstances of the Jewish people. It all hinges on this moment in the narrative. In other words, there was a decree in force at this point, and then after this point, it's all downhill for Haman and uphill for the Jewish people. Now, file that away in your brain for a moment. The equivalent moment in 3 Maccabees is this. Haman is the head of the way that the Jews were going to be killed in 3 Maccabees. It must have been serious when it was written. I can't help but chuckle when I read it. They were going to be gathered in a stadium, and they were going to be, and then the Haman, who was the trainer of the elephants, was going to get the elephants drunk, and then these drunk elephants were going to run over the Jewish people. This was the creative way that the Jews were going to be destroyed. So, Haman, who was the elephant trainer, and all the friends of the king pointed out, the beasts and the forces for killing the Jews have been prepared, O king, according to your urgent proposal. But at these words, the king, Ptolemy, was filled with extreme wrath, because his every thought concerning these matters had been scattered by the providence of God. In other words, Ptolemy's decision, Ptolemy sort of changes his mind at this point. Now, what is the difference between the change of heart that occurs in Esther? I think there are several differences. What is the difference between the change of heart in the king that occurs in Esther and the change of heart that occurs in 3 Maccabees? In 3 Maccabees, Ptolemy changes his mind because God forces him to change his mind, so to speak. That's number one. And what about in Esther? How does the king change his mind?
He's informed.
He's informed by Esther. And who is Esther? What is she? She's a Jew, right? It's a Jew who takes the initiative and changes the king's mind. It's a Jew who is in power, who is in the government, who engages in political action, who works hard to lobby the king and change his mind. It is noteworthy, I see some smiles already, it is noteworthy that in all of 3 Maccabees, there is not a single Jew, at the very least a Jew who is not an apostate, there is not a single Jew who is a member of government or who plays any role in governmental affairs. File this away for a moment.
Can you see a parallel in
Haman and Hermon?
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. I had thought about that. I don't know if there's any evidence that Third Maccabees knew about Megillas Esther. I suspect that they did, but I have no way of... I suspect that they did. I have no way of proving it. I was thinking about the same issue myself. Hermon, Haman, it can't be a coincidence. Someone must have realized this before me. But I have no evidence one way or another. But I think it's worth pointing out. There certainly is that parallel there. Now, take a look at this next parallel. Look at the next passage. Vayivadoha davar l'Mordechai, vayageid l'Esther hamalka, v'tomer Esther l'melech b'shem Mordechai. At the very beginning of the narrative of Megillas Esther, or near the beginning, there is a plot to assassinate Ahasuerus by these two fellows named Bigson and Seresh. Their plot is foiled because Mordechai finds out about it, and he informs Esther, who's his sort of his agent in the king's palace. Esther informs the king. The plot is foiled, and Mordechai is rewarded. Right? And the thing, the translation of the verse, and the thing became known to Mordechai, the plot to kill the king, who told it to Esther the queen, and Esther told the king in Mordechai's name. Now, parallel passage in 3rd Maccabees. In 3rd Maccabees, there's also a plot to assassinate the king. But Dositheus, now, by the way, we actually have recovered archaeologically papyrus that belonged to this very Dositheus. The reason we know it was his is because this Dositheus is called the son of Drimalus. Drimalus is a very rare name. We have a papyrus by a Dositheus, son of Drimalus, who was a priest, who was an Egyptian priest. And it happens to be that this Dositheus was an apostate to the Egyptian religion. So it's actually quite remarkable. Dositheus, called the son of Drimalus, a Jew by race, but one who later had abandoned the observance of the law and had become alienated from the ancestral teachings, had led Ptolemy Philopator away and arranged for a certain undistinguished person to lie in the tent. In other words, there's this plot to assassinate Ptolemy on the field of battle, and this Jew, Dositheus, comes along, and he saves him, just like in Megillas Esther. Now, what's the difference between the two? Major difference. Who saves the king in Megillas Esther? Mordechai. Who is Mordechai? What role did Chazal think that Mordechai had? Ira mentioned it before. He was a member of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly. This is the sort of council... the council of sages that presided from the end of the prophetic period until basically the beginning of the rabbinic period. This is sort of the chain of rabbinic thinkers. So Mordechai, whether or not he was a sort of rabbinic figure as Chazal painted him, whatever his role was, he certainly was what? A leader of the Jewish community and a committed Jew. Who saves the king in 3rd Maccabees? Who is Dositheus? Right, he's a Jew, but he's an apostate. In 3rd Maccabees, the apostate Jews are the ones who are the big villains because they are helping to persecute the Jews. They try to kill the other Jews. In other words, the Jews don't just randomly slaughter them at the end of the book. It's this sort of give and take. It doesn't make it any prettier, but it's this sort of turn and turn about. But this is another key. Who saves the king? Who plays a crucial role in preserving the royalty, in preserving the royal line, in being loyal to the state? In Megillas Esther? It's the leaders of the Jewish community. Who does this in 3rd Maccabees? These renegade Jews, who are villains at the end of the book. And then finally...
maybe they're trying to set up a juxtaposition of the apostate Jew is the one that led to the attempted sacrifice or the attempted worship in Yerushalayim, which then set up the stage. And it's the apostate Jew saved the emperor who then was going to kill us.
Ah, right, in other words, right. That's a good point. In other words, maybe this is not meant to be a good thing, right? In other words, meaning now that this apostate Jew saved the king, he has time to persecute us, right? There's. I don't know if any of you know this song. It's a song that my family sings on the Shabbos. There are two versions of it. It's my mother, who's a Beis Yaakov girl from Cleveland. The words that she learned were Hodu Lakel Yitain Toda. Basically, thanks be to the Lord because He's great and He's wonderful and everything. The version that they learned in Camp Morashah, which my father learned, was Hodu la Sultan Yitalal ki Uzalal v'Usovei. Thanks be to the Sultan because he's such a glutton and a pig that he doesn't have time to worry about persecuting the Jewish people. So that's the version that they have. So it may be something along those lines. In other words, how could you save this maniac who wants to just kill us? Look what you did. But I think it still underscores the point that in the 3rd book of Maccabees, there's a basic hostility that exists between the Jewish people, the Jewish community, and the Hellenistic rulers. Whereas in Megillas Esther, I think there's a much more productive, wholesome relationship. As much as Ahasuerus in the book of Esther clearly seems to be a buffoon. The fact of the matter is that there is a productive relationship between the Jews and the state. Yes?
But it's also the motivation of the actor. I mean, Esther is acting on behalf of the Jewish people to save the Jewish people. Here, it's sort of that in Maccabees that he's sort of accidentally Jewish and he's
exactly
acting on behalf of the Jewish people.
Right.
He's just doing it probably for allegiance to the state, not to bring a good name to the Jewish people.
Exactly. Exactly. In other words, there is a sense of Jewish as a policy. In other words, there's a policy of Jews being loyal. Whereas in 3 Maccabees, it's sort of incidental. He is a Jew, but that has nothing to do with his loyalty. Yes?
What's the Hebrew word for race?
For race?
Yeah, a Jew by race.
I should mention, that's actually an excellent point. The third book of Maccabees is composed originally in Greek. So the term that's probably translating, I would assume, is ethnos. But I would have to look it up. Which would be basically... This is actually an interesting point, which we probably won't have time to discuss throughout the rest of the semester, but at what point did Jews, how did Jews always self-identify? There are some cases where it seems that Jews, that you were a Jew because you lived in Judea. There are some cases where you were a Jew because you observed the covenant. There are some cases where it seems you were a Jew because you married a Jew. What does all of this add up to? Interesting question, but for another time. Right. So there, in other words, at what point this becomes emphasized by Jews that being Jewish is has an ethnic component? I think that as with all of these ways to identify Jews, whether it be religious practice, fealty to the Almighty, where you live, who your parents were, all of these things appear at some point in Chumash and Tanakh. The question is, at what point do they become emphasized? That's a different thing. But the idea of Jews as a race, the race of people, gets strong influence in, during the second, has strong emphasis during the Second Temple period. But there are other aspects of it too, yes.
Nation as a race?
So, unclear. In other words, it's... Right,
it's not how he identified himself, it's probably how the people saw him.
Right.
He probably wasn't even practicing Jew, so
right.
He wasn't a Jew by religion because he didn't practice. He was a Jew by race because that's the way he was identified.
Right. So what's interesting is that the third book, and I think this is something that you're pointing out, the third book of Maccabees here differentiates between some...
The Hitler version of a Jew.
Right. In other words, the third book of Maccabees is interesting in this respect. I think you're right, because it distinguishes between someone who is an ethnic Jew and someone who is a practicing Jew. That seems to be a distinction that we find here. Oh, in other words, would we say today...
They use that we're a religious group. We're not a religious group.
We're a race.
Group.
Right.
But to me, a race is the four races.
In what respect? I understand the point that you're making. In other words, you're right.
It's a national group.
You're right. I think you're correct. Well, I just want to quickly get through to the next one. But I think you are right to point out that there certainly are ethnic components. The idea of calling different religions faiths, I think that as we'll see, and we've already seen that develop in some of the classes this semester with Paul. That's a very Christian Pauline notion that a religion is a faith. As a belief. I think you're right. Okay. I think you're correct about that. Now, the last source here, and this is, I think, a crucial source that goes underappreciated in discussions of these issues. Look at this pasuk from Megillas Esther. V'yikahalu ha-yehudim asher b'shushan, gam b'yom arba'asar l'chodesh adar, v'yargu b'shushan shalosh me'os ish, u'v'abizah lo shalachu es yadam. The Jews of Shushan, once Achashverosh rescinded the decree against the Jewish people, rise up, and they fight against their enemies. So the Jews in Shushan came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Shushan 300 men, but they didn't lay their hands on the plunder. That's the pasuk that tells about the Jewish victory in Megillas Esther. File that away. Here's what we have in 3 Maccabees. And on their way, in other words, on their way from being saved from death in the Hippodrome, the Jewish people returned to their homes with license to destroy their enemies granted by the emperor himself. And on their way, they killed and slew, as a public example, any compatriot they came upon of those who had defiled themselves, and on that, namely the apostate Jews. And on that day, they slew more than 300 men. So this seems to be, at first glance, superficially, a remarkable parallel. In other words, they both have the same exact number of people who are killed. what is the essential, there are at least two that I can think of, what are the essential differences between the passage in Megillas Esther and the passage in 3 Maccabees? Who are the victims? Who are the victims in Megillas Esther?
Our enemies.
Enemies. First of all, they're Gentiles, and second of all, so we'll figure out how the Jews, why the Jews considered them enemies in just a moment. But first of all, they're Gentiles. In 3 Maccabees, who are the victims? Apostate Jews. So it's worth noting two things, I think. Now, the other point is, do the Jews, is there any point in Megillas Esther at which the Jewish people rail against, or which anybody, any Jew, talks about their enemies as being Gentiles, or just the answer is, I'm asking this rhetorically, the answer is no. The enemies of the Jewish people are always called oivim, enemies, people who are threatening us. In other words, there are people threatening us and we have to deal with that threat. Other people who do not threaten us, the book of Megillas Esther says, misyahadim, they became allies with the Jewish people. It may mean to convert, that may be anachronistic at this point, but whatever that term means, it may mean that they converted, but in any event, the Gentiles who did not threaten the Jewish people, they allied with the Jewish people. In the third book of Maccabees, there is this constant refrain of, oh, these evil Gentiles, they're trying to kill us and persecute us, they're essentially evil, and so on and so forth. So here, it's fascinating to me that the Jews of Shushan, of Persia, felt comfortable asserting their right to liberty and independence within the context of the state. And when people threatened them, even though they were part of the majority culture, even though Gentiles, the majority Persian or Babylonian Gentiles, whoever it were, who were threatening them, the Jews felt comfortable killing them, fighting against them, and standing up for themselves. In 3 Maccabees, the Jewish people, as much as they feel persecuted by the Gentiles, don't take out their wrath on the Gentiles. They don't feel comfortable doing this. Who do they take their wrath out on? Other Jews. Other Jews. So if I had to add up the picture that we're getting from Megillas Esther on the one hand, and the picture that we're getting from 3 Maccabees on the other, it would be this. We have a couple minutes, just 2 minutes left. In Megillas Esther, we have a picture of a Jewish polity that sees its role, that sees itself as playing a role in the Persian state. We have Jews who are members of government. We have Jews who actively try and save the king's life with no apparent gain coming from. In other words, without being able to anticipate that this would help the Jewish people. In other words, Mordechai saves the king's life because he hears about it. He hears a plot. He reports it. The Jews actively try to save the king's life. The Jews feel comfortable when they are threatened using diplomacy to convince the king that they should not be killed. The threat to the Jewish people, in fact, does not come from the king. It doesn't come from the state. It comes from this sort of minority cabal within the Persian government. And the Jews are simply another group that has to lobby to protect their interests. Moreover, the Jews feel comfortable. The Jews feel as if they are a part of the state. In other words, they see themselves as playing an integral role within the context of the state, so much so that when members of the majority culture threaten them, the Jews are not too timid, or not so timid, that they back down from a fight. The Jews feel, if we are threatened, we will fight back. If you want to ally with us, we're absolutely thrilled to have you. Misyahadim, you'll become allies with the Jewish people. We're thrilled to have you. But if you threaten us, we will fight back. Esther. In 3 Maccabees, the Jews see themselves as aliens within the context of the state. They don't try and save the king's life. In fact, who saves the king's life? A renegade Jew. The king himself is the one who threatens them. The only way that the king becomes convinced not to kill the Jewish people is because God miraculously intervenes. The Jews see themselves as so alienated from the state that when they're threatened, they don't feel comfortable. They are too afraid to stand up to the majority culture, and instead, they take it out on other Jews. This is what happens in 3 Maccabees. Yes?
I don't interrupt your thought, but I mean, the way I look at this, in Esther, they're directly responding to a threat. And it seems like in Maccabees that it's almost like, well, you're not, not Jewish enough, or you're not practicing enough, and that's the motivation that they're acting on.
Right, in other words, right.
And also, actually, in Esther, I don't really see Shushan as a democracy where they decide to lobby their legislators. I mean,
right.
Esther was really nervous.
That's
I mean,
true.
Maybe at the end, the Jews were empowered, and after be reinforced that, okay, the government's on her side, they go up and kill them. But, I mean, that was the whole thing with the fast, and she was really...
Right, this is true. Right, this is true. In other words, we shouldn't paint too rosy a picture of life in Shushan. In other words, it's still a tyranny. Nachashverosh is the final word on everything. But I think granting all of that, that said, Esther certainly feels that it is within her abilities, whether even though she's nervous, because obviously a lot hinges on this.
She feels that it's right.
But in 3rd Maccabees, this isn't even an option. There aren't any Jews in place to do this. The whole government is Greeks. Yes.
So it goes back to what we said earlier about the absence of God and the presence of God. In 3rd Maccabees, the argument is we've got to rely on God. And
right.
If you leave us and try to go to the other side, you know, it's not going to help you. It's going to hurt you, and we're going to kill you. Because we're not going to get killed, because the only person we can depend on is God.
Right.
And Esther, you know, they pray, whatever it is. She doesn't pray, she fasts,
right.
But we've got to make our own decisions, and, you know, who knows why you're here, but you're here and you've got to act. And they're
active. Exactly.
They're proactive as opposed to just...
Exactly. Pray. That's the ultimately this boils down to. The Jews, in other words, Megillas Esther sees Jews in the diaspora as having to put their faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but having to be active stewards of Jewish survival and Jewish vitality. Whereas in 3rd Maccabees, the Jews are sort of victims who rely ultimately on divine succor and don't do anything on their own behalf. This is why I think it's interesting, and this is the very last source, in the Greek additions to Esther, which is also composed in the context of Greece, they refer, just at the very first line, "For Haman, son of Hamadasa, a Macedonian without any Persian blood and quite devoid of our goodness, was treated by us as a guest." And then it goes on to say he eventually turned on Mordechai. This is one of the letters that the Greek editions sort of fabricate when Achashverosh rescinds the decree against the Jewish people. And Achashverosh refers to Haman as a Macedonian, as a Greek. He's not a Persian. He's a Greek. Now, obviously, this is incredibly anachronistic. There were no Greeks involved in higher level government.
He's an enemy.
Right, he's an enemy, but what sort of enemy?
He was at war with Persia.
Right, exactly, right, exactly. The Greeks were famously at war with Persia. Right? Thucydides writes about this and so on and so forth. So rather Herodotus writes about this. So why is this, why is it important? Why did the Greek editions must have known that Haman couldn't have been a Greek. Why did they refer to him as a Greek? As we said before, remember, the Greek additions to Esther are not just influenced by Megillas Esther, they're influenced directly by 3rd Maccabees, which means what? The attitude of 3rd Maccabees, that ultimately those who are persecuting us are just Gentiles generally, not some random minority cabal, but Gentiles generally. This attitude makes its way into the Greek editions, and this is why they refer to Haman as a Greek. Because for them, for the people who wrote the Greek editions to Esther, who would have been the Gentiles that were surrounding them at the time? They would have been Greeks. So the Greek additions to Esther saw the enemy as the Gentile rather than just as Haman. Now, why is this important? I don't ultimately care about the theology of the Greek additions to Esther. We care about Megillas Esther. All of this, 3rd Maccabees and the Greek additions to Esther, point to the fact that if you just read Megillas Esther without all of these additions, without 3rd Maccabees and without the Greek additions, what should emerge from us, and in fact, it's difficult to get this out of Esther unless you know what the alternatives are. So now we know what the alternatives were. What should emerge from Esther is that a Jew who is living here, while there is a state, in other words, while there is a state in Israel, what should be the role of the Jew in the diaspora? How should a Jew act here? Should we see ourselves as victims, acting passive-aggressively, as people who do nothing? The answer is no. The answer is we fast, we rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we always trust that God will come to our salvation, will come to our rescue, but we must see it as our responsibility to be involved in government, to be involved in taking control of our own fates, to standing up to those who threaten us, and welcoming as allies those who wish to treat us well. That I think should be the role of Jews in the diaspora. That, I think, is the message of Megillas Esther for the Jews of the Gullus. Although obviously the ideal is to return, that is the role that Jews should see as their own in the diaspora. And I think it's only appropriate, of course, for those who are not going to be with us next week, that you are not going to be joining us because of precisely that charge which Megillas Esther gives to the Jewish people, which is to say, safeguarding the vitality. And the continuity of the Jewish people by playing a muscular role in the context of the American diaspora. So with that, I will conclude, and thank you so much for coming to this little Purim installment.